Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jennifer Clark of the Brennan Center for Justice, who provides an update on legal challenges to voter suppression laws across the U.S., and concern about Donald Trump's call for election observers to root out alleged voter fraud at the polls. Journalist Shane Burley, who discusses how alt-right white supremacist groups are attempting to organize a base of support on American college campuses. And Chris Schweitzer of New Haven, Connecticut's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge, who explains why his group displayed 24 inflatable aliens on a city street to promote dialogue on the issue of climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Growing skirmishes between Islamic militants and India's army in the disputed territory of Kashmir has fueled fears of a new war between India and Pakistan. In late September, India conducted a well-publicized raid, crossing the line of control into Pakistan to destroy militant camps. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has come under intense pressure from Hindu nationalists to retaliate against a militant raid that killed 19 Indian soldiers at a Kashmir military base. As hostility worsens, one of the casualties may be the binational Indus Waters Treaty, where India and Pakistan have jointly managed water resources vital to South Asia. The water treaty, which dates back to 1960, has survived numerous conflicts between the two nations. On September 22nd, India threatened to revoke the Indus Treaty. Pakistan's Foreign Minister, Sartaj Aziz, called any move to revoke the treaty an act of war. Pakistan currently gets 80% of its water from three rivers managed under the treaty, which flow mostly into irrigating crops. Pakistan threatened to bring the issue before the United Nations and the International Court of Justice. The $40 billion hedge fund Akzif Capital Management has agreed to pay over $400 million in fines for bribing numerous officials in Africa in order to gain access to natural resources. In a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the hedge fund signed a deferred prosecution agreement related to its actions in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Libya, Chad, and Niger. The federal corruption probe focused on the activities of Michael Cohen, the hedge fund's former head of European investing, who oversaw investments in Africa. Working with an Israeli businessman, Cohen bribed Congolese officials to win natural resource deals. According to Reuters, the Israeli associate paid over $100 million in bribes to officials in the Congo between 2005 and 2012. In a move related to the Africa bribery investigation, a Gabonese national, Samuel Mebiame, was recently charged with conspiring to bribe foreign government officials to obtain mining rights in Chad, Niger, and Guinea. He allegedly worked as a fixer in a venture co-owned by Akzif. Years before the U.S. opioid addiction crisis exploded, a small group called the Pain Crisis Forum, dominated by pharmaceutical drug companies, warned Congress about an impending crisis of chronic pain afflicting 100 million Americans. Yet a letter to U.S. senators on the looming pain crisis completely ignored the rising number of deaths from overdoses of prescription drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, and Percocet. The Pain Forum and its pro-industry allies had considerable influence inside the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in crafting a proposal to battle the crisis of opioid addiction. According to an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity and the Associated Press, the Pain Crisis Forum, a network of drug companies, trade groups, and pro-industry nonprofits, spent $740 million funding lobbyists on Capitol Hill and dozens of state capitals between 2006 and 2015. The same drug industry groups donated $140 million to candidates running for state and federal office. In contrast, groups promoting new restrictions on painkiller drugs raised only $4 million for lobbyists and political donations. Congress recently passed election year legislation that improves access to treatment for opioid addiction, but it imposes no restrictions on the distribution of painkillers or mandates any training for prescribing doctors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After the Republican Party won a number of key elections for governorships and control of state legislatures across the U.S. in 2010, 21 states passed an assortment of new laws that make it more difficult for specific groups of citizens to vote. These measures include restrictive voter ID laws, reduction in the days and hours of early voting, obstacles placed on registering new voters, and accessing absentee ballots. These voter suppression laws were made possible in large part by the Supreme Court's 2013 ruling that gutted a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. With the threat that a large number of voters, especially minorities and young people, could lose their right to vote as a result of these measures in the 2016 presidential election, legal challenges were mounted to overturn these laws in federal court. By late July, some legal efforts succeeded in overturning or modifying several voter suppression laws in North Carolina, Wisconsin, Kansas, Texas, Ohio, and Michigan. While restrictions on voting rights remain in some states, these victories were substantial. However, there's growing concern that GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump's charge that the November election will be rigged and his call to supporters to become election observers to challenge alleged fraud at the polls could result in attempts to intimidate certain groups of voters when they show up to cast their ballot. Your reporter spoke with Jennifer Clark, a counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program, who discusses the status of efforts to overturn voter suppression laws and the potential damage from organized voter intimidation tactics at the polls on November 8th.
So we've seen a ton of lawsuits, and many of them successful, actually, over the summer and into the fall that have really pushed back against a wave of restrictive voting laws. I think some of the most high-profile ones have been pushback against strict photo ID laws that require voters to show one of a very small number of IDs to vote. We've seen a court in Texas, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals actually say that Texas had to make changes to its ID law because it was discriminatory against African American and Latino voters there. We saw a federal court in North Dakota say something similar about that state's strict law, which actually disenfranchised the Native Americans there who were less likely to have access to photo IDs. We've seen a lawsuit in Wisconsin that's been going kind of back and forth and back and forth over both voter ID and some early voting restrictions, and we actually got a decision that created more early voting opportunities for voters there, finding that the law had been passed with the intent to make it harder for African Americans there to vote because African Americans disproportionately in Wisconsin tend to use early voting opportunities. We've also seen a monster of a lawsuit in North Carolina because North Carolina passed an omnibus restrictive voting law in the wake of the Shelby County decision that kind of hobbled the Voting Rights Act and made it much easier for states to pass these kinds of discriminatory laws. And they passed a law that really hit all the notes of making it harder to vote. And there was a decision in the summer from Federal Court of Appeals there saying that North Carolina's law was passed, again, with the intent to make it harder for African Americans there to vote. And they actually wiped the entire law off the books. So we've seen a lot of litigation around these issues, and a lot of it is going in a good direction for voters.
Jennifer, Donald Trump says that if he loses the election, it'll be proof that the election was rigged around the country. He's also made a call out to his supporters to become citizen poll observers, which seems some coded language to try to intimidate voters of color, possibly Muslims, and certainly young people might be targeted by those supporters if they do show up at the polls. What are some of your concerns at the Brennan Center about this call for, quote-unquote, ballot security?
So it is very concerning to hear a call for voters to go and kind of police other voters at the polls. That has a very problematic history in our country that goes back to Jim Crow and earlier, where we have seen a lot of very zealous policing at the polls that actually at the end of the day results in intimidation for voters and creates a very intimidating circumstance. You know, people who might have good intentions going down to the polls, there's clearly been a lot of feelings and, you know, emotions are running very high around this election in particular, and things very quickly have a chance to, you know, spiral and to cross the line from watching into intimidation. And so we're very concerned about that. We think that's a real problem. And we have, on our website, have been putting out a lot of information about what's actually legal and what crosses the line into intimidation. And I would strongly encourage people to try to, make sure that they watch out at their polling place, make sure that no one is around to intimidate them or, you know, showing up and walking around in police or military garb. And I would encourage folks to call election protection hotlines if they see that kind of behavior going on at their polls.
Summarize for our audience a bit about what the Brennan Center's thinking is in some long-term remedies and reforms that will prevent these kind of blatant attempts to prevent certain groups of people from casting ballots. It seems like we're going backwards in so many ways. I know one of the things that the Brennan Center is advocating is a rapid restoration of the Voting Rights Act. But maybe you could expand on that briefly for us.
In 2013, the Supreme Court really hobbled the Voting Rights Act by striking down a part of it that required states that had a history of discrimination in voting at the polls to pre-clear some changes. And that law worked very well. And we have seen since it has been struck down that there has been a wave of restrictive voting laws that have come into place. So this idea that it wasn't working anymore, it wasn't doing the job it was supposed to, which, you know, seemed to be the Supreme Court's reasoning and its opinion and Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, you know, that's been proven false. And so if you look, for example, at the overlay between states that have passed restrictive laws and states that were previously required to pre-clear their laws under this part of the Voting Rights Act that was struck down, it's a pretty high percentage. It's a pretty good match. So it was obviously doing its work. And the Brennan Center and others in the voting rights field are working very hard with Congress and with bipartisan support in Congress to try to get the Voting Rights Act restored, to update the coverage formula so that the states that have a recent history of discrimination in voting would have to pre-clear their laws again. And so we could prevent years of litigation, which is really what we've had to go through to get to this point to reach those victories I was talking about. We could prevent the years of litigation and the loss of votes throughout the course of the litigation if really states had to make sure that things were okay before they put them into place.
That was Jennifer Clark, counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice Democracy Program. Learn more about challenges to voter suppression laws and methods to counter organized voter intimidation tactics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump appointed Stephen Bannon as his new campaign CEO on August 17th, many questions were asked about Bannon's links with white supremacist, misogynist, and anti-Semitic bloggers and groups who had found a safe haven on the popular right-wing Breitbart website where he served as chairman. Bannon and others on the alternative right or alt-right movement have no consistent or officially recognized ideology, although commonly held views include opposition to multiculturalism, immigration, and feminism, as well as an affinity for white nationalism, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and nativism. Democratic Party presidential nominee Hillary Clinton responded to Bannon's appointment to lead the Trump campaign with a speech in Reno, Nevada in late August devoted to denouncing Trump's divisive rhetoric, appealing to the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right. In that speech, Clinton warned that a nationalist conservative fringe had taken over the Republican Party. Stephen Bannon's rise to lead a major party presidential campaign and the alt-right support for Donald Trump has apparently emboldened and reinvigorated the right-wing movement. Now there are reports that prominent figures and lesser-known groups linked with the alt-right are attempting to cultivate interest and recruit new members on college and university campuses across the U.S. Your reporter spoke with journalist Shane Burley, who discusses his investigation into the activities of the alt-right in academia, featured in the recent article, How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses, co-written with Alexander Reed Ross.
It was a new strategy for them. What they were trying to do was get under the radar of local anti-racist and anti-fascist organizations and then be able to hold an event that essentially kind of looks good to the media, it looks good to passing students, and it looks good to their own media really well. And so what they did was they only announced it about 48 hours in advance. And so this is a few groups, some of which we know and some of which we don't. The National Policy Institute's been around for a number of years. It's kind of taken the lead in terms of this new buzz around the alt-right. So they recently put on a large press conference in Washington. They've been leading the large conferences. Richard Spencer, who's the director of it, has been kind of out in front fielding, interviews with reporters and things like that. And he's been kind of the person that coined the term alt-right, and he's kind of been maybe like an ideological forefather for it. But then this other group, Identity Europa, is really kind of was doing the groundwork at Berkeley, and they have been, not just in California, but in Portland, Oregon, in the Midwest. There's been signing the posters on the East Coast, trying to create kind of a nationalist student group, a fraternal organization, as they like to call it, that's going to be on college campuses and appeal to young people, and to try and do what a lot of leftist groups do on campus, which is to create kind of a campus culture.
Shane, what's been the reception on college campuses like Berkeley and the other universities and colleges that they've tried to organize rallies and recruit members?
It's been mixed. It hasn't been great, generally. They're not getting warm welcomes. Milo Yiannopoulos, who's well-known for writing at Breitbart, he's what you call an alt-light. He's more kind of a diet alt-right. He kind of mainstreamed their opinions without maybe having a lot of the baggage. He's getting challenged at a lot of his university speaking events, but they are sold out nonetheless. People like Richard Spencer, they're not well-known by administration. A lot of the student groups that would challenge him don't really know the baggage he brings in. He's not waving a swastika. He's not coming in a clown robe. So it's not quite as obvious. And so there hasn't been a large-scale student movement against it. When it's made obvious, it's pretty roundly rejected. What's gone over a little bit better is alt-right students going into Students for Trump organizations. And that's something we've seen on a lot of college campuses. In Portland, Oregon, at Portland State University, Portland State Students for Trump was alleged to be harassing multiracial student organizers, really kind of making a nasty culture on campus. And that's run by, alt-right ideologues, young people that are on these alt-right message boards that are kind of creating a community amongst those. So that's been kind of their entry to get a little bit more high profile. With groups like Identity Europa, it's really too new to tell. Anti-fascist organizations off campus have been responding really strongly to them, but it's yet to see if they're going to have much of a pull on campus.
Shane, are these groups at all associated with violence, whether directed at particular students or student organizations anywhere around the country?
I think the answer is yes and no. Their entire existence, the entire way they function, their talking points, their messaging, their branding, all of it is based around the idea of taking their white nationalist message and stripping away the connotation of violence. The problem is that white nationalism is a history of violence. It's completely inseparable. So you take Nathan Domingo, who founded Identity Europa, and he will strip all forms of racial slurs and violent language out of his discourse. But of course, he served over 5 years in prison for violently attacking a Muslim man. American Renaissance is a really great example. They will talk about, peaceful politics, this and that, but if you look at the crowd, you're going to have skinheads, you're going to have neo-Nazi party members, you're going to have Klansmen. And the same is true of League of the South, Council of Conservative Citizens, all these groups that have a kind of close, tight network and kind of make up a lot of the core of the alt-right. And then at the same time, you have groups that have been associated with the alt-right that are actively recruiting from that kind of more violent undercurrent. So the Traditionalist Youth Network, which we mentioned in the article, they recently held an event in Sacramento, and they decided to invite Golden State skinheads and Sacktown skins, two skinhead gangs, and ended up stabbing seven counter-protesters. I think eight or nine people ended up in the hospital. So this is something that happens relatively regularly when you have this long history of this kind of violent confrontation. And it's really hard for the alt-right to completely reject it because it's something that's really baked into their ideological legacy.
That was journalist Shane Burley, co-author along with Alexander Reed Ross, of the article titled How the Alt-Right is Trying to Create a Safe Space for Racism on College Campuses, published on the Waging Nonviolence website. Find a link to the article and learn more about the alt-right movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Widely respected climate scientist James Hansen and other experts have long insisted that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere cannot remain above 350 parts per million if we hope to maintain any semblance of life on Earth as we've known it. That warning was underscored when the level of carbon dioxide surpassed 400 parts per million for the entire month of September 2016. In fact, every month for the past three decades has seen hotter than average temperatures. A new paper published by Dr. Hansen and his colleagues declared that reducing the amount of heat-warming gases like CO2 and methane released in the future will not ensure our survival. The scientists maintain that governments working together must devise new methods to remove massive amounts of existing global warming gases from the atmosphere, which is an extremely difficult challenge. This challenge is made more difficult, especially in the U.S., by the propaganda churned out by the fossil fuel industry and allied politicians that has been a major obstacle blocking congressional action while the severity of climate change grows more dire. One group in New Haven, Connecticut, has initiated a new effort called Let's Talk About Climate Change, as a strategy to challenge congressional gridlock. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with New Haven's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge organizer Chris Schweitzer at a downtown New Haven intersection where his group set up a display of more than two dozen colorful inflatable plastic aliens. Here Schweitzer explains the message being sent with this offbeat art installation.
So we're using the aliens to get people to think about how, through climate change, humans are creating an alien planet, a planet that has different climate and weather systems than what we've known for all of human history. And we're particularly inviting people to start talking more about climate change. We're organizing a Let's Talk About Climate Change events and inviting other folks to likewise have informal or formal discussions and just get people talking about climate change.
And how would that work? Do you have experts come, or is it just a group of people?
So on our website, this is being organized by Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge. And on that website, we have a lot of great resources, videos, discussion guides, graphics. And it could be as informal as you want. Have people over your house have a discussion, put a sticker on, sign up in your office. Just get people talking about climate change. Because we started this because different surveys have shown that even though people are concerned about climate change and aware of it, they feel like it's too hot a subject to talk about it, and that other people don't want to talk about it. But surveys say most people do want to talk about it. So we're trying to, through posters and stickers and discussions and this kind of event, invite people to talk about it more.
You've got these signs and which says, all those scary movies about aliens destroying your world, and you're doing it to yourselves.
Right. So we have a lot of kind of wise-ass signs that different people made up about, aliens coming and saying, this is our planet B, where's your planet B, kind of thing. And just part of the kind of idea to get people thinking about what we're doing, kind of fun, whimsical way.
So while I was waiting for you, there were five guys, workmen, having their lunch break, just sitting on the steps where we're sitting right now. And I went over to them with a sticker and asked, if anybody wanted to talk about climate change. And One guy very vocally said, no, thank you. One of them did take the sticker, and we ended up having this fascinating conversation about insulation and different kinds of insulation and how this one kind is really the best. It's also the most expensive. And then I said, but if you live in your house long enough, over time, you'd not only recoup that, you'd start saving money on it, right? And he said, yeah, that was sure. And then one of the other guys said, we carpool. That's our contribution. And I said, hey, you know, that's great. That works. So, I mean, it was sort of this whole, let's talk about climate change, microcosm of, you know, four or five people just sitting
right,
here.
Right.
And some, you know, just actively refusing to engage. And, you know, it's an interesting question about, you know, what do they think people are telling them they're going to need to do? How much are they going to have to suffer versus how much, if they don't do anything, they're going to have to suffer down the line? So are there any particular approaches or factoids that you think are particularly good to engage in this conversation?
Well, we really think the policy change is really important for the state, particularly to really, you know, try to cut back on fossil fuels, cut back on natural gas use, you know, support policies that encourage people to weatherize their homes, support policies that encourage solar and community-based solar, because that's where you really get the most impact, is changing the systems away from fossil fuel-based energy systems and transportation systems to ones that use clean energy, wind, solar, and other forms of energy. But for individuals who just care right now, you can look at your own, you know, greenhouse gas, your footprint, and make some choices, because most choices, in our estimation, that are good for your own health and good for community health also cut greenhouse gases. Biking more, walking, taking the bus once in a while, carpooling, you know, weatherizing your house, eating more local food. These are all good things for your health, for the environment locally, and for cutting greenhouse gases.
And some of them certainly would also save the person money.
Yep.
That was Chris Schweitzer, an organizer with New Haven's Healthy City, Healthy Climate Challenge, and program director with the New Haven León, Nicaragua Sister City Project. For more information and resources on the need to expand public discussion on climate change, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.